but right now it's science with a couple of Massey University specialists in genome sequencing. I'm talking to Dr. Nikki Fried. Kia ora, Nikki.
Kia ora, Brian.
And Dr. Olin Salander. Kia ora, Olin.
Kia ora, Brian.
Now, you are involved in a project to create a more robust, a quicker, more affordable way of sequencing the genome of COVID-19, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad you said yes, otherwise I've got the wrong people on.
Indeed.
Now, can you just tell me again, when you sequence a genome, what are you actually doing?
Right, well, I guess one of the important things that a genome sequence can give you information on, at least in the context here, is transmission chains. So how a virus has been passed from one person to the next. And maybe a good way to for a concrete example of that is for all the people that we have in isolation now. Some of them are positive and some of them may pass the virus on to someone else. And if we want to figure out which individual has passed that virus on, then if we have the genome sequence of the viruses for all the individuals that are in isolation, then we may be able to figure out which individual passed that virus on.
What is a genome sequence?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
So maybe we should start from the beginning. So
yeah.
All living things have DNA as their genetic material, or, you know, all plants and animals and bacteria. And viruses also have genetic information. And in particular, the virus that causes COVID-19 actually has RNA as its genetic material. But that's generally it's four different sort of letters to the genetic code. And what we do when we sequence the virus is that we determine the sequence of the virus. So we detect exactly, it's about 30,000 base pairs. So these letters are called base pairs. And we can sequence and detect the entire sort of all the base pairs in the genome. And we do that actually in our lab at Massey using handheld DNA sequencers that are really these cool sort of devices which allow us to, in real time and very quickly, give that information or basically detect that sequence of the genome.
Now, Olin, you were saying before you can use sequencing perhaps to say who had the virus and who passed it on. If you isolate the virus, how can, when you do sequencing, then work out who might have had it before it got to the person you took the sample from?
So all the SARS-CoV-2 viruses now circulating population differ from each other by between 0 or 1 and say 20 or 30 mutations. And those mutations have just been building up since the virus was first spreading in China. And as a virus is transferred from one person to the next, it may accumulate one mutation or one change in its DNA sequence. And then it will be passed on to another person. It may not change in that person. And then it will be passed on again. And so over time, those changes build up.
And if there's no mutation, then you wouldn't be able to tell whether person X. If it doesn't mutate as it leaves person X, then you won't be able to tell when you sample it in person Y that person X had it or person before X.
Yes, that's exactly true. But what you do have right now is because the virus has infected so many people is you have a very large number of strains of different viruses with different genomes circulating. And so we may have something on the order of 1,000 different strains or more that are circulating right now in the population.
What's the chance of a mutation occurring with each transmission from one human to the next?
So I think the mutation rate of SARS-CoV is actually relatively low. So that's the virus rate that causes COVID-19 is relatively low compared to many other similar viruses. So Nikki mentioned that it's an RNA virus, so many other RNA viruses. And I'm not going to guarantee this, but as far as I know, the mutation rate is something in the order of 1 out of 10 transfers will maybe result in a mutation.
Nikki, how are you able to see, because these things are microscopic, you able to actually see in sufficient detail to be able to actually tell, it's mutated, this one?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's definitely a bit of inference. So it's very difficult. DNA or RNA is so, so small. So you can't, even a virus actually is so, so small. It's you need a very specialized microscope to even see a virus, so an electron microscope. So We are not using something like a microscope to like look at the DNA. We use, as I mentioned, this handheld DNA sequencer in it. It's a bit complicated, but it takes the RNA and convert it to DNA, and then that's a little bit easier to sequence. And so the DNA basically goes through this small pore and changes the conductance or the voltage in a membrane, and based on the sequence of the DNA, it changes the voltage in a slightly different way, and we can infer what those bases are that I was talking about. So what A, T, C, and G, sort of the letters of the code. And
your sensor must be incredibly sensitive to a change in voltage.
It is.
Yeah.
And there are different ways of sequencing DNA. And so I mentioned we use these handheld sequencers, but there are other methods to do this too. So yeah, and you have to do this many times over. So usually we sequence like one genome 100 times to really make sure that we've got the sequence right so that we can make sure that it's really accurate.
That change in voltage, is that caused by the fact that certain elements of the genome will have certain materials that will have a difference in conductivity, and you can tell? It's like a fingerprint, being able to recognize that without actually being able to see them?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. So, and very smart. So, yeah, each base, and actually for this technique that we're talking about, it's actually four or five bases at a time that it's looking at. And the combination of those bases, because they are a little bit, they have a slightly different shape, it will change the voltage. And actually there's a whole number of very smart people who have developed different algorithms for detecting the sequence. So they use machine learning and neural networks and all these things I don't fully understand, to be honest. But so it's a pretty interesting technology. And what's really cool about it is that it is handheld. We actually use it with high school students, not for COVID testing, but just to show off, oh, you can sequence DNA using these really neat handheld sequencers. So it's a pretty accessible technology and sort of fun to use.
How long, say you get a sample from somebody, where would you get the sample from? Down the nasal cavity or saliva?
Yeah, actually that's something. So our lab is, part of the work that we're doing is working out, and we've done this, is work out faster, more robust methods for sequencing the virus. And another aspect of our work is also trying to also make that testing faster and easier and cheaper. So we're actually right now working on, typically when you go in to get a COVID test, it's a swab from the back of your nose.
A lot of people don't find particularly appealing.
No, I agreed. So there's obviously a lot of motivation to maybe change that sampling a little bit. So we're working with a group at Yale, a woman named Anne Wiley, who's she's from New Zealand originally. And her group, or people at Yale University in the U.S., are working on, and a number of other people too, but are working on using saliva instead of this sort of slightly uncomfortable nasal swab. And I think we've got some things that are looking really promising. So she's going to, because we don't have a lot of people in New Zealand, thankfully, who are infected with COVID right now. So she will be taking our methods that we've developed and testing them on real patient samples using saliva. So we're really hopeful that that might be the future of testing, is to use in methods that are less invasive, and they don't require, they don't require sort of a clinician to dress up in full protective gear to take that swab, and you can basically sit in your car and maybe, or at home and spit in a tube and send that off. And that's a little bit safer for everyone and easier and just less uncomfortable.
And that's one of the reasons you're doing this, is to make it easier to test for COVID-19 and also quicker.
That's right. Yeah. So I think it's a virus that's going to be around, it seems like, for a while. And anything that we can do to make it easier and faster and cheaper to test people will help us to get this virus under control and hopefully help us to live in a COVID-free world in the future.
Olin, now this sounds great in practice, but I would have thought that if it was easy to do, other people would have done it already. So what are some of the barriers you've got to overcome to make this a practical solution or practical approach?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. And it is true that there are a lot of people working on this, but that's not to say that there's not just some very sort of regular problems that you might think of. You know, we're trying to develop tests that use samples from saliva, and you know, one of the problems with saliva, of course, is that it's not easy to pipette in the lab. And so this is one simple problem that we've tried to address, is to add the right sort of chemicals to it that might make it easier to pipette. You know, so solving just simple problems and doing them in ways that if you try enough different ways, so hopefully someone will work out a way that's better than the current ways. And this is really an effort, I think, and this is true for a lot of the research that's been happening for COVID-19 and on SARS-CoV-2, which is that it's really involved really rapid communication between a lot of scientists, and it's enabled us to collaborate with people at a speed that we never would have been able to collaborate at with before. So when we do, you know, the research that we're doing, we're informed about what other people are doing, not because we read articles anymore and not because we wait for publications, but because we're on Slack channels with people talking about the best way for this and that. So any lab just about that makes, you know, any progress, very quickly a large number of other people will know about it.
Sorry to be dumb here, but what's the Slack channel?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm still working in radio here.
Slack channel. Yeah. Slack channel is like messaging for work, you know, so it's just sending text messages.
Oh, what, like a top liner or something like that? That's what we call this here.
Oh, see, I don't know what that is either.
Yeah, well, now we're even, except that top liners are in the 20th century. You're in the 21st.
Right, so there you go. So you can imagine that instead of waiting for publication, we're not even sending emails back and forth anymore. We're sending text messages to each other. And this happens. We wake up every day and check our Slack channels and see what sort of progress anyone's made.
See, that's one of the things. It's encouraging to hear that, because part of the narrative about international coverage of, well, the international issues around COVID-19 has been, I guess, some of the antagonism between various nations and blocks of nations over what's going on here. It would be nice to think that maybe this will bring out a bit more collaboration between people from different countries as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I guess I have to bring in sort of the caveat, which is that we're not trying to make any money off this, and I think most scientists working on this aren't trying to make any money off of it. So, of course, it's not true that companies are necessarily sharing all their secrets. But there are definitely some companies out there that are sharing some of their secrets and are willing to collaborate. And so we're talking with one of those companies right now, which is Octant, which is based in Los Angeles, who've developed a new method for testing, so not sequencing, but a new method for testing.
Dumb question again, but what's the difference between sequencing and testing? Is sequencing something you have to do to do a test?
That's a good question. So there is a big difference. So when we say testing, at least when we're talking about this work that we're doing, is we are testing for an active infection. So when we say take in a nose swab, that nose swab, we use a method called PCR, and it's basically a way to detect some of that genetic material from the virus that causes COVID-19. So then once we have maybe found a patient who is infected with COVID-19, then at that stage we can say, okay, this person does have the virus, and we can take that same sample that's already been tested and do a little bit of further work on it and then get the sequence of the virus. And we wouldn't that's, again, a very specific test. So we don't, like, just randomly start sequencing. We usually just sequence samples that are positive already.
How important is that second aspect in terms of us understanding where the virus has come from, where somebody might have got it from, picked it up from, and also how quickly it might be changing itself?
Yeah, I think that's it's an important part of it. So testing is also very important to know when someone's sick, to be able to, you know, advise them to stay home and to try to make sure that they don't infect anyone else. But then that second part of actually sequencing the genome of the virus gives us information about transmission. So some of the work that has been done in New Zealand already, the reference laboratory here, ESR, has sequenced the majority of all of the patient positive samples. And that gives us information about how many times sort of the virus came into New Zealand, and gives us an idea about transmission. So we know that those were multiple introductions that happened. And we can also look at specific mutations that seem to be becoming more frequent. So there is a particular variation or mutation called D614G in a particular part of this virus that seems to be spreading, or predominantly So it's the majority genotype now of this virus. So it's important to keep track of what's going on with the virus in terms of what mutations are happening. This gives us information about transmission. It also can help us a little bit to inform some for the people who are making the vaccines. It gives us information about what strain or what virus to use for that vaccination strategy.
Well, I'm guessing it could tell you, for example, if there's a case now, say if we unfortunately got a case in the community, you could perhaps tell whether it's actually from a strain which came in quite a long time ago and was hidden in some pocket of the country and we didn't notice it and then suddenly got out, or whether it's something that's just been brought in by somebody who's somehow got through the quarantine system, that wasn't picked up by the quarantine system.
That may be a little bit more hard to really tell. I know in Australia they've been able to do a lot of information almost in real time, looking at the outbreaks that are happening in Australia and trying to look at what were the transmission chains there. How did those outbreaks happen? Were those multiple introductions? Did that happen from a quarantine facility? So we can get some general information about what's going on. I want to have a little bit of put some context here. It's not always that easy to say, well, it came from this person. It's much more general. So because this virus, as Olin mentioned, it doesn't change that often. So we can get some general information about transmission, but it's still very important to be sequencing these viruses and to be keeping up with what's going on. And it does give us some information about transmission.
That's right. Sorry, I'll carry on.
Yeah, I'm just going to quickly mention one interesting thing that can confuse us every now and then because we don't have enough information, and that is whether or not there are some people that are infected with two different kinds of viruses. This is something that hasn't been really well investigated, but certainly could be affecting how you infer transmission chains, and it's an area of active research right now.
Does it also have implications for the way that the virus presents in terms of the health impact? I'm wondering, for example, whether the strain D614G has any obvious clinical obvious symptoms that are associated with it as opposed to other strains of the virus.
So the testing, I think, that has been done so far in terms of, say, whether D614G variants are more virulent or present in higher levels in patients. I don't think there's anything conclusive to say that one thing or the other. There is data from laboratory cells that are grown in the lab to say that the virus with that mutation can spread more easily. But whether that is actually relevant for how it spreads between people is really an unknown right now. And I wouldn't say that there's good evidence to say that that is, in fact, why that variant, why that virus with that mutation is spreading so fast. There's two possibilities. One is that it's spreading, yes, because it is more virulent. But the other possibility is that it's just random chance.
One of the issues that I think we have to grapple with at quarantine is the problem of false negative results in testing. And maybe if you're unlucky enough to get two of those when you've actually got the virus and then out you go into the community and then the community becomes unlucky as well. Is your work likely to help with that at all?
Well, I think the strategy right now of testing at day 3 and day 12 is a really good strategy. I think that's probably going to catch the vast majority of cases. There is always this chance of, there is some limits to these tests. Generally speaking, these tests that when we use PCR to test for this virus, these are usually quite specific and quite sensitive. But we still don't know that much about, there are different aspects in terms of how you swab the patient and at what stage or what progression of the disease they have. So all of these different variables can contribute to false negatives. So these tests can even go down to 5 viral particles per test. So they can pick up a very, very small quantities of virus. So they are quite sensitive. But, yeah, still there is this chance that you have a false negative. And that is a real risk. So that's why we need to continue being vigilant and making sure that we do our contact tracing and are still continuing to do widespread testing in the community.
As you mentioned before, we are at the moment in this country quite fortunate that we don't actually have many active cases that you can test your work on. So you've got to get help from somewhere which is less fortunate than us. But when are you likely to get answers back as to whether what you've got is efficacious?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's a really good problem to have, to be honest.
Yes.
So,
well, I wouldn't get too gleeful about it, but no. it's nice to be there right now.
Yeah. Right. So it really is dependent on we're going to ship off actually some of our protocols and reagents to this group at Yale and also actually a group in Oregon as well. And I would expect in a few weeks to get an idea about how efficient these are in some of our tests are in real patient samples.
And then maybe soon people will be able to spit rather than, I don't know, stick their nose up in the air and hope for the best.
Well, yeah, I think there's still, you need to do a lot of testing to make sure that those types of tests are really robust. Obviously, like we just mentioned, we don't want any false negatives or false positives. So you want to make sure that those tests are really good and well designed and very robust to lots of different variables. So it's hard to know exactly when the tests that, you know, if our tests really do work on patient samples, when they could be available. But I would hope within a matter of months.
And I'm just going to mention one more thing. So there is an important divide between testing, which has real clinical implications, immediate clinical implications, and genome sequencing, which doesn't necessarily. And so the time it takes for different groups to adopt changes in those methods can differ. So there are already many groups around the world that have adopted the methods that we developed for genome sequencing. On the other hand, seeing if other groups are going to adopt methods for isolating from saliva or new methods to isolate the genetic material, this can take a longer time.
Yeah, the stakes are much higher.
Erlen, Nikki, thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much,
Brian.
Thank
you, Brian.
That's Dr. Nikki Fried and Dr. Erlen Salander. They're both from Massey University, both working on sequencing of the genome of the COVID-19 coronavirus.